The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 61.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. My guest today is Julie Borowski, who has a very popular YouTube channel that has, I'm checking it here, as of this point, she's got 89,000 plus subscribers, and her total views are about 10.8 million. So those are some impressive statistics. Julie also, she has a website, libertyjunkies.com, and she's the author of a new book that's coming out in September called Nobody Knows How to Make a Pizza. And we're going to be talking about all these things in the forthcoming interview. Let me mention, Julie does have a promotion where you can give your email and then get entered into a contest to win a free signed book. So the link for that will be at the show notes page, as well as, of course, the links to her website. And also in the interview, she's going to mention some of her viral videos. You know, I asked her which of your videos that you uploaded to your channel, you know, stand out to you. So she mentions a few. So we'll put those in the show notes page. If you've never seen her videos, I really encourage you, before you listen to this interview, you got to go watch her videos, right? Because you got to see who you're talking to, because she's very soft-spoken in the interview and unassuming, but she's got a zany sense of humor. And you, once you see her videos, you'll understand, oh, yeah, that's why she's got 10 million plus views. So without further ado, here is my interview with Julie Borowski. Well, Julie, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Julie, as my longtime listeners know, when I have somebody who's well-known in libertarian circles, I will ask them the obligatory opening question of, how did you get into all this stuff?
All right, so let's go back. Around 2005, 2006, I was a hardcore Republican, probably because of my family. And I started to have doubts about the Iraq war and foreign policy. And I was like, wait a minute, I know I'm not a leftist. I know I hate communism. So what the heck am I? And I found the world's smallest political quiz online. I took it. It said I was a libertarian. I thought, wow, cool. I have a name for myself, but I didn't know what to do with it. And then 2007 rolled around. I was watching the Republican debate.
Can I stop you, though,
yeah,
for a second?
Go ahead.
So what was it that made you have doubts about, was it the Iraq war, you said, in particular?
Yeah.
What was there any, like, was there certain commentaries, or just you on your own started just thinking, wait a second?
Well, I had a friend whose husband went to Iraq, and he came back, and he was pretty screwed up by the whole situation. I realized, you know, how many people were dying. Like, conservatives, we talk about, you know, limited government, small government, and then we have this big government foreign policy. And I was like, wait a minute, this seems pretty inconsistent here. So I started to have doubts about that. But like I said, I knew I was not a leftist. I knew I wasn't a Democrat, but the Republican Party seemed like I wasn't really fitting in here. So yeah, I found out what a libertarian was. And then 2007, I found out about Ron Paul. And then I was like, whoa, I found my person here. He's basically saying everything I think and more. I learned about the Federal Reserve, which before I really had no idea about. I learned all kinds of stuff through Ron Paul, and I got really excited about it. And then I guess kind of, you know, I got involved in commentary. I worked in D.C. at think tanks, and a bunch of stuff came from Ron Paul.
Okay, that's great. And so I learned of you, I guess, because you were making videos, and that's what put you on my radar. But so can you just tell us a little bit about were you working for an organization and then were doing that on the side, or how did that actually get going?
Yeah. So 2010, I started working at FreedomWorks. I had an internship there and they hired me. And it's funny because I was a big Ron Paul supporter. Everyone there knew I was a big Ron Paul supporter. And one day, a news organization came to my boss and asked if FreedomWorks can come on to talk about Ron Paul on TV. He couldn't do it, so he asked if I could do it. And at that time, I was a writer. I had never done any interviews. I had never done any TV interviews, anything like that. So I was freaking out. Like, I want to talk about Ron Paul on TV. That is awesome. But at the same time, I felt I was going to puke if I would ever go on TV.
Wait, so, do you remember what it was? Like, what the channel was or what show was?
I really don't remember. It was a long time ago.
I mean, was it something big? Like, was it huge or was just, it was the fact that it was TV?
It was national TV. Okay. However, so my boss said, oh, we have this girl. Her name's Julie Borowski. She's a big Ron Paul supporter. She can go on to talk about Ron Paul. Well, they came back to my boss and said, oh, well, she hasn't had any TV experience. We can't put her on, obviously. This was live national TV.
Right.
So I heard that and I said, oh, well, I need to practice if I'm ever going to be on TV. Like, that's a big deal. So I decided that at that point to start a YouTube channel. Like, if they weren't going to put me on TV, they wanted me to have practice. I was going to practice myself. So that was actually the whole reason why
that's
I started
funny.
I've never
heard that. I don't think that part of the story. Okay.
So I was so nervous about being on TV because public speaking makes me really nervous. Like, even to this day, I was so nervous about it. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to practice on YouTube. And YouTube gives you a lot of constructive criticism, right? So I just threw myself out there on YouTube. I started talking about Ron Paul. I started doing the interviews myself. So that's kind of how I started my YouTube channel.
Huh. Okay. That's good. Yeah. I mean, for people who don't know, it really is amazing. Not that I'm, you know, some anchor of a major network or something, but yeah, it's the few times I've done TV, you always come off stiffer than you think you are.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And you get nervous and lose your train of thought or whatever. So it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in the beginning, when you said did interviews yourself, do you mean you were playing both parts or you mean you would go interview people?
So I would ask.
Because I've seen you do certain things that are comedic where you're playing multiple roles. So I don't know if you were making a joke there. You meant that seriously.
Well, I asked people on Twitter, like, ask me questions about Ron Paul. And then they would ask me questions and then I would respond to them. So that was kind of me interviewing myself, but through other people. Yeah. But basically, I gave myself a platform when other people wouldn't give me a platform.
Okay. That's great. So how did you... Did the show evolve over time? Because I know, like, I've seen, but when I saw it, you were like, your mature channel, as it were. So I'm like, you know how you watch the first few episodes of Seinfeld or the first season, and it's not the same as later seasons. So I'm saying, was it right out of the shoot? Was it like you would come to be later, or did you, as you got more followers and you know, did you make it get more bells and whistles and take time to make more intricate videos and things like that?
Well, I was really, really awkward in the beginning. I was pretty stiff because it's nerve-wracking to even put yourself on YouTube because you know you're going to see the comments. You know people are going to be mean to you. And I know that I was not experienced. Like, it's really, really awkward to sit in front of a camera and talk to it and then upload it to the internet. So I was really nervous and awkward and stiff. But, I got practice and people were like, hey, this is actually kind of good. I was like, oh, okay, I got more confidence. And then I started kind of going crazy because what I realized is that I was trying to be like every single other libertarian commentator out there. I was sitting in front of the camera. I was being serious. I was talking about Mises and Hayek and all these important people. But this wasn't really resonating with normal people. Like I decided, hey, I'm going to show my personality a little bit more, my silly, goofy side. And as I did that, people loved it. And it was so different. And it really set me apart. So I kept going down that road and people loved it. And I was like, hey, maybe I have something here.
Okay. Yeah. And then eventually, I mean, so how did you learn? I mean, you were doing things that realize I'm bouncing around here. But I remember like one video in particular where you were playing multiple characters. And you kept doing like costume changes and stuff. So I'm just logistically like, number one, how did you figure out how to do that? And then number two, when you would film a video that had you being, let's say, three different characters with costume changes, did you do like everything you needed for the one character, then change and do everything for that, and then merge them, you know, splice them together? Or did you change? You get what I'm asking?
Yeah. No, when I was a character in one costume, I filmed the entire thing and then I would change costumes and then I'd put it together. Yeah, no, that'd be weird if I did it like that. Actually, there's a YouTuber called Jenna Marbles and she used to be really big 2012 and she did these costume changes. Also, there's a YouTuber called Miranda Sings. If you have like a 12-year-old girl, you know who I'm talking about. And they did these costume changes. So what I did is I looked at other YouTubers, the YouTubers who are getting millions of views, and see what they were doing. And they were doing these costume changes. They were acting silly and goofy. And I kind of miss that YouTube. I feel like YouTube nowadays, people upload like half-hour freaking TV episodes. I miss the short like 5-minute skits. That's what I love to do.
Are there, and I agree with you that it's certainly changed. I mean, from my perspective, the stuff that I was in, it was like there was this brief period where all the economists would argue with each other on blogs, and there would be really long, intricate blog posts. And now, like, people move beyond that. And you're right. It's weird that the attention span. So in terms of reading stuff, it's gone down. But in terms of listening, like in the podcast world, I guess maybe it was Joe Rogan who did it. But all of a sudden now, yeah, it's like an arms race to see who can release the longest episode. I guess, are there any of your YouTube productions that stand out to you? Like, we'll link to some. So folks, this is BobMurphyShow.com/61. Are there any that stand out to you or things that maybe you say, oh, and this one, I tried this new technique for the first time, you know, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot that stand out. There's a couple ones that went semi-viral that people know me from. Like when people say, oh, I saw this video from you, they're usually talking about this video. I did one, it's called F-Bombs for Feminism, which got a lot of views. Basically, there was this group called F-Hate, I think they're still around, where they do these skits with these little kids and they drop a bunch of F-bombs and inappropriate words for feminism. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I've seen your version of it, your spoof of it, but I didn't really know what you were actually poking fun at. I don't know.
Well, you have to watch the original to understand. But they basically put a bunch of little kids and talk about feminism and anti-Trump stuff. And basically the kids are saying a bunch of political stuff and F-bombs this. And I kind of did a parody of that where I dressed up as a princess. People know that one. I've also done one mocking Lena Dunham, who is this very radical feminist. So I think those are probably the ones that stand out the most. That's where people know me as. But I've done a whole bunch.
What was the one where you like smeared oatmeal all over yourself? Do you remember that one?
Oh, yes. There was this college that came out and said how to prevent rape, throw up. He'll get disgusted and leave. I was kind of mocking that as, you know, maybe we should teach women self-defense instead of telling them just to puke. Yeah.
Okay. So there in the context of the video, it was vomit. It wasn't like you were using oatmeal, but it was simulated. Mean, gotcha.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Cause I just remember that you had oatmeal and I couldn't remember what it was. Okay. Very good. So people can see here that you're willing to go the extra mile to get the point across. So, when you were doing that, I'm just curious what was your creative process? Like would you just sit back and then if an idea popped in your head, or would you get a cup of coffee in the morning and say, I have to come up with an idea cause I got to make the video tomorrow. And, you know, even if I don't like it, I just, whatever the best idea is, that's what I'm running with. Like, were you on a schedule where you had to keep producing at a certain time, or could you sit back and would you wait for something to inspire you?
Well, the best videos are where you sit back and you wait for something to inspire you. And that's kind of where I'm just looking around, seeing what's going on, see what's trending, see what people are talking about. And I kind of get like I get visions, okay, where I'm just like, okay, this, I have a vision here. I'm going to put it with something here. And I get this paper and I just kind of jot down a bunch of ideas and kind of put it together. And it's a whole mess. But eventually I come up with this idea. I think if you are like on a schedule, like some YouTubers do, I have to release a video every so often. Yeah, I think sometimes you put out videos that you aren't necessarily that proud of, that it kind of seems forced, and your audience will eventually tell that from you. So I tried to do it where I'm actually motivated and, hey, this is actually something I'm proud of.
Okay, yeah, I go back and forth with that because on the other hand, it seems like if you're too sporadic, then you're not going to build up, people aren't going to get hooked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like I know when I used to listen to talk radio, I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh, for example, a long time ago. And once it got to the point where, you know, I really liked it and I would want, you know, if I got in the car and he was on, I would turn it on. It's like you started, you know, going through withdrawal if you didn't have it. And so I see what you're saying, but I can see it going either way where if you're, it sort of takes the pressure off. Like the audience can forgive you if they know, oh yeah, he's doing a video every other day or something or whatever the schedule is. that they build that into their expectations. And so, yeah, occasionally when you hit it out of the park, that's even more special, but they start just taking it for granted. And, you know, it's the thing they long for.
Yes.
So how did you, I'm just really curious, because I was, for a period there, my partner, Carlos Lara, and I, we were my co-author and business partner, we were putting up a lot of videos, and it was really, and I called in a guy who was a professional, you know, video guy, to give us some tips about just things like framing. And I mean, there's a lot that the lighting that's involved. It's like, there's so many different ways. It's like with baking, like when you start baking for the first time, you realize how many different ways you can screw up making a cake. And so like the same thing here, it's like there was 16 different things that you had to do so it didn't look awful. And I'm wondering, like, would you go and look at YouTube tutorials? Did you know somebody who was a professional that came in and would give you tips? Or how did you get to, because the videos you were cranking out, they, I mean, they look pretty professional.
Oh, well, thank you. The first lot of videos I did not look professional at all. They were awful. The lighting especially was terrible. I just kind of learned as I went. There was a lot of trial and error, but I think that's what my audience liked. Like, they knew that I was not a professional actress that some libertarian hired to try to get views. Oh, female libertarian, let's put her on my YouTube channel. That they knew that I was the real deal, and they could tell I was the real deal because my production was so awful. Like, clearly.
You passed the savings on to them.
Yeah. So eventually, you know, over time, years, it got a little bit better. But I think people could still tell that I was doing everything myself. And I think that's what made my videos so genuine, because I have done I've done videos for The Daily Caller. I've done videos for FreedomWorks, and they look a lot better because there is a professional there doing the videos for me. I have the green screen and everything. And people tend not to like those as much because they like just me. They know that this video comes from me and not some crew telling me what to say. No one has ever told me what to say, but basically I think they like just me doing it myself.
Okay. But what even, like when you're doing the costume changes and stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, that was, like I said, you were doing stuff in those videos that I didn't know how to do. Like, were you the one actually splicing those things together, you know, with the video software, or would you outsource that to somebody?
No, I was doing everything myself. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's pretty impressive, I gotta say. So, yeah, most of the stuff you were doing, I mean, I understand the logistics of how you could spread oatmeal on yourself if you wanted to, but yeah, the costume changes and how you were having that be real quick change, that was good. Well, the reason we have you on here today, Julie, is you have a new book coming out. So, do you want to tell people about that?
Sure, I have a book coming out. Talking about my YouTube channel. A lot of parents have told me that their kids actually like watching me on YouTube because I know how to make things fun and simple. And a lot of them have said, hey, you should write a children's book. And I thought, hey, that seems like a cool idea, but what am I like, you know, I don't want to be like creepy indoctrination of kids or anything like that. So one day, talking about how I get ideas, I was rereading iPencil, which most of your audience probably knows this story. And I was thinking, huh, this is actually a really fascinating story that probably kids will like. How can I make it even more kid-friendly? And I thought, pencils are, you know, kind of boring. How about pizza? Kids love pizza. So I said, huh, I'm going to write a book called Nobody Knows How to Make a Pizza, a twist on iPencil. So I did this book. You've read it. I got a really great illustrator to make.
Hey Julie, let me just, on the off chance that somebody in the audience hasn't read iPencil, can you just really quickly explain what that is? And then the transition to your book will make more sense.
Sure. So iPencil, in case you haven't read it, is this fascinating story about how nobody knows how to make a pencil. And you think, wait a minute, a pencil seems so simple. How do you mean nobody knows how to make it? Well, actually, there's millions and millions of people involved in making a simple pencil, and they all work together. It's kind of the invisible hand, spontaneous order, and everything comes together. And I thought, okay, how can I make this more kid-friendly? Well, pizza. Kids like pizza. So I decided to make this book called Nobody Knows How to Make a Pizza with this pizza character. And this book is really, really cute. My illustrator did a fabulous job, and kids will love it. If you love iPencil, you will love this book too.
And yeah, let me second that. I have an advanced copy of it, and I sat down to read it, and it does exactly what you know, you would hope. So congratulations, Julie. You pulled it off. I mean, obviously anyone hearing this can see what the concept of what you were going for. But then the question is, yeah, is it going to come off like it's real academic and the kid feels like, oh, someone's trying to teach me something? Uh-huh. No, it's a real fun book and the illustrations are great. So I'm there. How did you, what was the process by getting the illustrator?
I use this website called Upwork.
Okay. Yeah. I've used them too. So, and I'm just curious because the illustrations, they're really perfect for the, you know, the spirit or the theme of what you're doing here, the feel of it. How did that, like, did you just give the text and the person just ran with it? Or did you say for each page, give me a picture of this?
So she had the text. I told her for what page exactly what I wanted. That's the reason why I wanted this book to be self-published. I really wanted to have control over this book and really be true to my vision. So yes, she did a great job, but I explained exactly what I wanted.
Okay. Let's take a break from my discussion with Julie to talk about my own children's book called The Three Lads and the Lizard King. It's a fun little story about three kids who have an adventure. There's some economics, but it's not just about economics. It's a good kids' book. Lots of rave reviews. For more information, go to bobmurphyshow.com/lizard. Let me ask you, this might seem like an off-the-wall question, but did you have to do any actual research in terms of, because like when I'm writing articles on stuff, like the other day I was doing something on a carbon tax and methane and I was like, you know what? I better go refresh my memory on the chemistry here. Like what's the difference? And so for this, like, did you actually have to go look up a bunch of stuff or did you know all these facts off the top of your head?
I did some research. Yes. Because I didn't want there to be like a stupid mistake in the book.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant, that you go and you just double check and, you know, go read the Wikipedia on certain things just to make sure like, yeah, okay, there's not something I'm smuggling in from when I was eight that I filed away. That's actually not correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause yeah, it's, I mean, obviously people get the premise and I just do like how you took it. I'm curious, did you like, once you thought of pizza, was that it? Or did you have like, did you consider an ice cream sundae and, oh, well, wait a minute, some parents might not want to do that cause it's dessert or that kind of stuff. Or was it pizza from the get go?
Actually, my first vision was tacos because I thought kids like tacos. But then I was like, okay, tacos, they have meat in them. I was like, I'm afraid parents won't like that if I get into the whole meat thing situation. Let's not make kids cry reading my book. And then I was like thinking like, okay, this has to be a simple food or a simple object because of the pencil is so simple. Well, okay, pizza, kids like pizza, but what about a cheese pizza? Because people think that cheese pizzas are really simple. So that was kind of my evolution there.
Okay. Yeah. I could see that with the meat. Yeah. And that
was
it. Okay. Good. You mentioned earlier, and I'm curious what your philosophy here is, that you didn't want it to come off as indoctrination. And I know exactly what you mean. Like, did you ever see, Julie, the show the cartoon Captain Planet? Do you know what that
is? Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So for people who don't know, when I guess Julie and I are close enough in age, when we were growing up, there was this show that came on TV when the, you know, environmental movement started getting really big called Captain Planet. And it was the most over the top indoctrination you've ever seen, where it was the stereotypical, you know, so Captain Planet was a superhero and he had all these kids from around the world that were helping him. And the villain was always like some corporate CEO whose mission in life was not to make profits, but actively just derive pleasure from polluting rivers and stuff like that. And so, of course, Captain Planet would stand up to him and save the planet. And their catchphrase was, the power is yours, right? So it was real over the and I knew, like, I never wanted to do that stuff in my work either. And so I'm just wondering, Julie, like, is it – so I agree. Reading this, I don't think any parent would worry. Like, even someone who didn't agree with you politically, this does not at all come off like, oh, this is a Koch brothers rag or something, you know what I mean? Like this doesn't seem like it comes off and political in any way. It just is truly educational, letting kids know this is how the world works. So I'm just wondering, what do you think makes the difference? Because presumably the people who made Captain Planet thought, no, we're just teaching kids about the importance of saving the environment. And if people recoil from that, that's because they're wrong.
What is the difference? I think it's just kind of mostly a feeling like, okay, this is creepy. This is not creepy. And I did not want my book to be creepy. I didn't want my book to be telling kids exactly I don't know. I think my book provokes them to think, but doesn't tell them what to think. I think there's a difference there because I want kids to be independent thinkers. I don't want to, you know, it kind of bugs me when people say, oh, you're having a little libertarian kid or anything like that. Like, I want the kid to be an independent thinker. I want them to question things. I want them to explore other ideas. I don't want them to be little parrots. So I think that's the difference. This book provokes thinking, but does not tell them what to think.
Actually, that's funny you say that, because, yeah, I've had that thought, too, whenever I talk about my kids or some, you know, that people will say, oh, so you're going to, you know, you're raising good libertarians. And it,
yeah,
you're right.
It
rubs me the wrong way. It's like, number one, mind your own business. But number two, mm-hmm. no, that's like, you know, when I'm teaching my son stuff, like, yeah, he's going to know a lot about certain perspectives. But it's more me informing him. Well, here's what, you know, this is the way. You're probably going to hear about it in school, but here's this other perspective. And certainly, yeah. you know, I'm not trying to ram it down. Because also, too, it doesn't even work. Like, if your child thought you were trying to force them to think a certain way, they would rebel almost just, you know, by default. So yes. not only is it creepy, but it doesn't work. So how do you feel about this? I think the difference is, like, the reason your book doesn't strike me as creepy and indoctrination is that you're letting them know how complex this thing is. Right. So you're right. It's not that you're saying if you were going to make a pizza, this is the way you'd have to do it. You're just saying, you know, you're giving them information and just showing them you probably think it's real straightforward on how to make a pizza. But no, actually, it's a lot more complicated. And here's some of the considerations that go into it. And so it's not like anybody could point to a page in the book where there's a false statement or something that's, you know, smuggling in a value judgment. Do you think that's part of why, you know, we think that this is not offensive in that respect?
Yeah, I think it kind of leaves a lot of questions for kids, which is good, because I want them to be like looking around at everything in their house and thinking, oh, how was that made? How was that made? And thinking about all the stuff that went into it. So I don't want this book to be that's it. I want them to think. I want them to question things. So yeah, that's the goal.
And I suppose too, you know, we as libertarians, we are more in line with free thought and perhaps too, since we tend to be in the minority in terms of public opinion to us, you know, the phrase free speech gets used in some cases, I think inappropriately, like, you know, when people say, oh, that's a violation of free speech. If the newspaper doesn't publish my letter to the editor, which, you know, no, that's not an example, but I think we are particularly sensitive to, you know, to just having people have a platform to be able to express ideas since we're so often in the minority.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And just again, to have people think, since our views are considered to be off the wall in many people's minds, it's we're winning half the battle just to say, hey, let's have an open mind about this since our stuff usually gets excluded from the outset. So I'm curious of your thoughts just, Well, let me ask you this. So people want this. Where do they go to get it?
It's going to be on Amazon on September 17th. It's going to be an ebook and a paperback, and the hardback is coming. I'm also going to offer signed copies on my website, which is libertyjunkies.com. So if you want like a signed personalized copy, they will be there.
Okay, so I'll put a link, folks, on the show notes page to her website. And again, the book is called Nobody Knows How to Make a Pizza by Julie Borowski. So I'm curious, Julie, in the time we have left here, can you speak a bit about, to the extent you're comfortable? So you were swept into this stuff. You said really catapulted you when Ron Paul was running. What are your thoughts in terms of, you know, like the energy, what was going right at that point? Because I think a lot of us felt like everything was hitting on all cylinders, that we got along with each other. And then once, you know, the Ron Paul campaigns were over, there turned to a lot of infighting. I know tons of people who are ex Liberty Movement folks, you know, just totally got repelled by it. And like, oh yeah, I put in 3 years and never again, that sort of thing, that where they burnt out or else they literally just couldn't stand some of the other people. So what are your thoughts on that whole scene?
Well, I think in 2008 and 2012, we had all a common goal. We all liked Ron Paul. It didn't matter. Oh, you're anarchist, you're a minarchist, whatever. It didn't matter because we all wanted Ron Paul in office. We could all join hands and kumbaya over it all day. But then after, you know, there was a lot of division about Rand Paul. Is he like Ron Paul or is he not his father's son? That kind of, you know, infighting. And then, of course, we have Donald Trump, which libertarians are divided on. I think he's libertarian on some issues, not so libertarian on other issues. And some libertarians say, you know, hey, he's the best we can get. While some libertarians believe he's a fascist dictator who's going to destroy the world. So there's so much division now, where before we had this common goal, and now there's just, well, first of all, I think libertarians in general like to fight with each other. I mean, you know, I say we were all kumbaya, but there was still some infighting back in the day. But overall, we still have this common goal. I just think it's kind of libertarians' personalities to like to fight with each other because we are so principled. But now there's not that really common goal that I think that we kind of need as a movement. Is there a libertarian liberty movement anymore? I don't know. I feel like we're so splintered and have so many different, we're going in so many different directions that it's kind of hard to say we're a movement. Are we really? I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I've noticed that as well. And so I don't know, like I'm religious. And so I move in different circles in terms of, you know, Christianity and how they have extremely passionate doctrinal arguments. And with all this stuff, it's like the people that are very close to you but differ on one or two points, those are the ones that anger you the most. And you know, another, so like for example, among Austro-libertarians, one of the big debates is over fractional reserve banking, which you would think in the grand scheme of things, who cares about that? Sure. But it's like, no, because we agree on everything up except this one little thing, you know, and it drives you crazy. Where somebody's a Mitt Romney supporter, it's like, I'm not even talking, or let alone somebody who's a Hillary Clinton supporter. Like, they're so far gone, forget about it. So I think there is that, because before, yeah, I used to just think there was something inherently obnoxious about libertarians. And then I realized, okay, oh, wait a minute, the people, you know, maybe it's Christians too. And then now I realized, no, I think it's probably just, you know, humans like to do that. Or perhaps yours, as you're saying, people who have a certain principles they adhere to that puts them in a group that's outside the mainstream. Mm. You know, that's a pretty generic description that applies to all the stuff that I've seen where you do have this. Because it's also true among like Marxists or let's say communists. You know, I mean, yeah, they all, you know, famously, you know, have their infighting and stuff that to outsiders look like real petty differences. Hey, you're all just a bunch of commies, but no, to them, it makes a huge difference, you know, whether you're a Stalinist versus a Trotskyite or blah, 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 or Lenin, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess there's that element. I'm curious, it's the obligatory question. Do you perceive a difference between like the average male who goes into libertarian thought on the internet versus female? Or do you think that's actually just a stereotype? It's up in the air.
What's the difference between
Right, like in terms of personality, like I've seen people say like, oh yeah, you know, the way all these guys just argue and stuff, that turns off women who otherwise are interested in the ideas because you guys just fight all the time and, you know, that kind of thing. Or do you think actually even that statement is a stereotype that really it doesn't hold water?
So I'm in a couple female-only libertarian groups, and I would say that they are more peaceful than other libertarian groups. I think you do kind of have a little bit of fighting, but overall, it's pretty cool. We're pretty chill with each other. Maybe it's just men, they just like to argue more than women, because I feel like women try to get along with each other more. I don't even know. I hate these questions because someone's going to get mad at me for generalizing, you know, but I feel like women tend to be more agreeable than men in general. Okay, people. That I feel like they like to argue with each other more than women do. Am I making any sense here?
Yeah, that's my view too, just so you know. I mean, that's partly why I was asking you, but I didn't want to like lead the witness. Yeah, when people talk like that, and I say, no, guys just like to argue about stuff. I mean, if you go, you know, you can go look up Google who would win in a fight. Star Trek Enterprise versus like the Star Destroyer. You know that, and you will see guys weighing in, and it's mostly guys weighing in with passionate arguments about why, you know, which Enterprise are we talking about? Is it Captain Kirk or, you know, that? And so anyway, and they won't just be emotional. They will sit there and, you know, they'll argue like men. We'll use reason and logic, even though they're talking about two hypothetical universes.
Oh my God. You know, I have been with a group of guys arguing about cars, which car is better than the other, for hours, and it drives you insane. It's just so boring. And oh my God, just shut up and stop. So I get you there, where I feel like women, they'll be like, okay guys, let's just get along. Let's move on, people. You know? Yeah. I think there's a personality difference there.
Okay. And again, folks, don't berate her. We're talking, we're making broad generalizations.
People are individuals.
But yes. Yes.
Okay.
We're not statists here, collectivists. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, Julie. Thanks so much for joining us. Once again, folks, the book is called Nobody Knows How to Make a Pizza. It's going to be available. What's the exact date it's available?
September 17th.
So I definitely, if you have kids, this is, or you know somebody who has a kid, this is going to be a very inoffensive way to introduce them to some of the ideas of free market economics. And good luck with all your future projects, Julie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.